Welcome to the Reason Round Table, your weekly look at the news through a libertarian lens, brought to you by the magazine Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mengyu Ward. Happy post-Memorial Day, humans.
Happy Tuesday.
Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
It's a chipper Gillespie we have here. It's be a great shortstop from the 1930 Senators.
I have no idea where I am, Matt. Yeah, but we're going to win. We're going to win today, Matt.
Someone had the no-dos earlier today. Yeah. All right. So as Peter and Nick were doubtlessly talking about before I joined the conversation, there were some really important television shows that came to an end this holiday weekend. And yes, I'm talking about the unscripted or supposedly unscripted debt ceiling negotiations between President Joseph Robinette Biden II and the Bakersfield Comet, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Those two,
make it a thing.
Those two pillars of the nation's political leadership came together on Saturday after a couple of weeks of active negotiation, many months of non-negotiation, to agree that there should not be any limit on federal borrowing until January 2025. And that one of the least numerically significant portions of the federal budget, non-military discretionary spending, should be capped for the remainder of this fiscal year and increased by 1% next year. Reason's Eric Boehm, in his initial reaction to the agreement, wrote, and I quote, "By abandoning the attempt to cut spending back to last year's levels, the deal effectively cements the new higher federal baseline established by December's omnibus bill. That's an obvious victory for Biden and the Democrats," end quote. In return, McCarthy got some minor changes to food stamp requirements, some trims in the huge spending increase for the IRS, and the official unspending of unspent COVID funds. Congratulations, America. Peter, you've had time to digest not just your Memorial Day brisket, but also this deal. What are they building in there, and what is a libertarian to think about it?
Boy, it's really exciting when they claw back $30 billion in unspent COVID funds. $30 billion, you know, that sounds like a lot of money, right? Like, and it is. Like, if I had $30 billion, that would be a lot more money than I have. But think about $30 billion in the context of $6 trillion. Because $6 trillion is what we spent in emergency COVID pandemic relief spending, basically in the space of a year, starting at the beginning of 2020 when the pandemic descended, and then right up through the first couple of months of the Biden presidency. 2020 to 2021, there was about $6 trillion of emergency spending related to the pandemic. Again, emergency spending. And so they're clawing back the unspent $30 billion of that. That's, I mean, this is, I'm trying to think of a good analogy here. It's such an incredibly tiny amount of money relative to the amount that was spent. And then what they're basically doing is they're saying, well, the COVID money that we spent, and then that giant omnibus that we passed last year, the $1.7 trillion like mega spending bill that came together in either, you know, 17 hours right before Christmas in December of 2022. You know what? Those spending levels, that's the new normal. The emergency part of the pandemic spending, it's no longer an emergency. That's just Tuesday. So happy Tuesday.
Catherine, not to encourage your nihilism, but should we add to your don't vote approach to life a don't pay attention to debt ceiling negotiations just for pure cost benefit reasons?
Absolutely, we should. You have very much hit it. This podcast is the single force tethering me to paying attention to debt ceiling negotiations because It's theater, and this is double theater, right? Because every single time we do this like brinksmanship thing, we do it with the budget too. And then, you know, in fact, Washington is mostly populated with adults, or the Hill is mostly populated with adults. I know that that's hard to believe sometimes because the children are so loud, but but they're going to get this done. Then they get it done every time. And then this time around, we had this extra layer of garbage, which was that they made all of these deals that were side deals to undo the deals that they made to get this thing passed. So there's the stuff with the COVID, the $30 billion of COVID spending, but there's also just a bunch of other really like just classic corruption or kind of classic, you know, smoky backroom type deals. A natural gas pipeline for you and, you know, a little bit of appropriations adjustment over here for you. And it doesn't, you know, it only matters if somehow everybody screws up and we actually don't raise the limit. And then it matters so catastrophically as to be the end of times, which is why it's fun to pay attention. But so far, every single time we do this, the outcome is the same. So paying attention to it is quite unrewarding.
Nick, I saw a poll 4 or 5 days ago that suggested yet again that using the debt ceiling as leverage to get federal spending cuts is still, after all these years, broadly popular and not just on one side of the political spectrum. Do you, oh, long memory having person, have some sentiments you would like to share, particularly with Republicans in Washington, D.C., for the way that they have acted on that fact about public opinion and the debt ceiling for the past decade or so?
Yeah, it's repugnant. The Republicans should be the Repugnicklicans at this point, Matt. They're
no.
deranged and just no. disconnected from reality. To me, what is stunning, shocking, and deeply disturbing about this is that they didn't raise the debt ceiling. They suspended it. So it's they're not even pretend. They're not doing anything anymore. I think of you know, Kevin McCarthy, the Bakersfield Comet, and Joe Biden. When I see them in the White House and they're wearing sneakers because each of them are old and their cloven hooves like hurt when they walk and stuff like that, it reminded me of going home after my parents had retired, and every couple of months or 3 months or 6 months, I would see them, you know, and I wouldn't see them in between. And I'd be like, wow, they are going downhill fast. Like they're no longer getting dressed in the morning. They're not shaving. I doubt they were bathing. They would go weeks without leaving the house. The degeneration of Congress and of the, you know, and of the White House, of the federal government is amazing. Like they can't even get it up to fucking actually increase the debt limit. They're just, we're just pushing it back until January 2025 because there's a good chance one or both of us will not be alive or sentient by then. So let's do that. It's really disturbing. It's super important. The debt limit is important because it does act as a regular check to say like, hey, maybe you shouldn't be spending so much. One of the things that
does it though?
No.
It has not performed that function in years.
It raises the question. People don't do it. But, you know, during the Obama years, when the debt limit really emerged as a, you know, as a point of contention, there were times where spending was cut. It was raised as an issue. You know, we lived in a day when Nancy Pelosi, when she was only 600 years old, ran in 2006 and won by promising fiscal responsibility on the part of a Democratic Congress, which she immediately, you know, but we were at least having that conversation, and we need to have it because, you know, and I say this all the time because it's true, unrestrained massive growth in the national debt. You know, debt finance spending reduces economic growth, which screws up everything in the economy. I posted on Twitter today a video I did in 2017 talking about why we needed to cut spending and reduce the debt when it was merely $20 trillion. You know, we're now like we're 50% further than that. And it will end poorly. So we need to keep having these conversations, and it's deeply disturbing. And to go to your specific prompt, Matt, the fact that the Republicans, they won't follow through on something. People say, yeah, we want a government to spend less or to debt finance things less. And they just are like, oh, they don't really mean that. What they really want are abortions, you know, banned before, you know, 60 minutes after sex or something like that. So they're going about this completely wrong. It is setting up a cataclysm for the Republican Party, which, you know, good for them. I don't care in 2024. But, you know, worse, it's really not going to help the country. We are looking at continued decades of lower than possible economic growth. And more and more kind of fighting over scraps and a way to keep the government growing as fat as it can, because we have incompetence in every branch of government, and we need to reel that back, and we need to reel that back through the ballot box, not the bullet box.
I should just note here that this is not the first time that Republicans have participated in suspending the debt limit rather than raising it. That is exactly what they did under President Trump. And there's a reason for this. It's because if they raise the debt limit by a certain dollar figure, that they feel like they will be seen as participating in authorizing that amount of debt to happen. And so what they do is they just say, well, we're going to make it a time limit rather than a dollar figure amount. And it's functionally the same thing. And while the calculations are a little bit fuzzy, we don't know exactly how much the debt and the, you know, is going to go up in the next couple of years while the debt limit is suspended here. We basically know. And so they are in effect authorizing a dollar figure.
Of course
they are.
What
this does is it allows them to get around, for political reasons, it allows them to avoid saying that they are authorizing a dollar figure.
I don't think, I agree with you, Peter. I mean, that's their stupid thinking. And nobody is fooled by it. Matt, you had mentioned, it's not simply the Democrats who benefit from unchecked spending. Most of that money goes to Republicans as well as Democrats. And most of it goes to, you know, Republicans in the form of things like Social Security and Medicare and entitlement spending. I mean, it is time, America. It is time to take the car keys away from our parents and grandparents. They are mentally incompetent, they're politically incompetent, legislatively incompetent. And the way to fix that ultimately is through voting them out of office or staging an insistent insurgent movement that actually is about reducing the size, scope, and spending of government.
Now they're just going to take it to the limit one more time, like the Eagles.
Sure.
Catherine, have you installed in the new office the kill Peter Suderman switch that we were talking about?
And I'm going to need to install one for each of you, frankly, so we'll have to see how that goes. Yeah, I mean, I do think Nick is right, of course, that it would be great if we had a serious move away from just adding to the debt infinitely. But I also think that's like, it's good that we have a conversation. Like, do y'all remember when that used to be the joke on the podcast, when Nick would be like, we got to have a conversation, and we would all laugh? This is a great example of why that makes us laugh, because we do have this conversation every time around the debt limit. And then we're like, well, we had the conversation, and we just go back to doing the bad thing. We need to do the work.
Good allies.
Oh, man, that's the only thing worse than we should have a conversation is we should do the work. That phrase
But there are times when, you know, when there is a consensus, you build a consensus to reduce at least the rate of growth in government spending or increase taxes. We had moments in the 90s.
I don't think that the debt limit thing is going to be, has ever been, will be in the future, the vehicle for
it
that.
It was, though.
I think this is just...
No, to Nick's point, it was under Obama.
Yeah. Going forward, it's not going to be. Everyone's figured out the workaround.
In fact, we had a conversation.
Yeah, I mean,
we had a conversation in which we came to a consensus, and the consensus was, we are not going to cut the two biggest drivers of long-term debt. And Republicans and Democrats came together to agree that Social Security and Medicare, which are by far the two biggest drivers of long-term debt, the two biggest fiscal problems for the country in the medium to long term, they came together and they said, there is no way that we will change those things at all. And Democrats said, well, we might change them to spend more, but we'll work that out between us. And that is the consensus. And that is a conversation that was had, and that the public is with them, unfortunately.
Let's say that conversation is not over, right? And it comes up at least every 2 to 4 years. And what needs to be done? And again, you know, as I get older, as I approach 60, I am really, really more in favor than ever of generational warfare. And this is where something people who are under 40 really should get motivated. And it's a nonpartisan thing. It's like, fucking kick rich old people off of all of this stuff and cut spending. Cut spending and cut taxes, and we'll have more than enough money to pay for the people who need it. And our economy will grow at more than, 0.5%.
I am also sympathetic to on the Hill, though. Like, the two choices that they have right now with respect to the debt limit, like, it's a problem of their own making. It is a garbage consensus. We all agree on that. But the two choices really are, like, kick the can or step on a landmine. Those are the only two choices that they have with respect to this conversation right now, right?
Can they push someone else on the landmine? I mean, I don't think Dianne Feinstein's going to put up a fight, you know, just...
Well, let's not... FBI, if you're listening, yeah. Nick is not trying to murder any members.
No, I love them all. I hope
my
they live forever.
Aside from Nick Gillespie continuing to go back and forth in his own brain about anti-ageism, is that there will be that bipartisan consensus, which is a real and active thing, will get us sooner rather than later to a permanent suspension of the debt ceiling. Like, it's not this... if you're not going to get anything out of it in the negotiation worthwhile, I think it's just going to be all cromnibuses all the time in some time in the future, at least until, to paraphrase Jim Morrison, the Lizard King, the whole and cover
Mr.
your ears,
Mojo
Fred
Young, Rising.
The whole shit house goes up in flames. Okay. Sorry for the foul language. I was told by Jonathan
Ed
Shades.
Matt, would you put your, you know, you're Johnson back in your pants. You didn't have to go full Jim Morrison in Miami, Florida, for God's sake. Lizard King.
I'm just going to zoom right over there. I just want to express my sadness that the peerless prognostications of Jonathan Chait, Norm Ornstein, Matthew Iglesias, Steve Bannon et al., that the Republican Congress was going to hold the global economy hostage to force cuts in Social Security because they do this in Chait's quote every time. I'm just so sad that this one time they might have been wrong. So buyer beware next time you hear people hyperventilate into thin air. All right, moving on. Last week
we should probably just clarify that at the time of this recording, it's not totally clear that the debt limit deal that has been announced is actually going to pass. And so it is possible that we will come back next week and there will still be no deal.
That is possible. I would take,
unlikely.
I would take
possible.
take the under on that one, but it is possible. We are seeing the backbenchers elbow for space in front of the cameras. Nancy Mace and Thomas Massey and Rand Paul and other people who are principled, some of them, about this issue, as well as other who like to express nihilism in the face of the Borg. All right. Speaking of the Borg, last week, Stuart Rhodes, founder of the Oath Keepers, was sentenced to 18 years in prison for seditious conspiracy. It's the longest prison term so far in connection to the January 6th, 2021 riots on Capitol Hill. This despite the fact that, as Reason's Jacob Solomon has pointed out, Rhodes's role in the breach of the Capitol remains unclear. He did not enter the building. He did not participate in the violence or the vandalism, and he was found not guilty of conspiring to obstruct an official proceeding. So it's a little bit kind of confusing around the edges. Catherine, I'm sure you've seen the various Twitter threads from critics of the length of the sentence, people comparing it to various lesser sentences handed out by the same court or district for things like stabbing people and whatnot. Doesn't it's funny. When is that not funny?
The way that you giggled on stab will haunt me forever.
I'm just imagining your terrible fingers on a knife once again. Doesn't 18 years seem kind of a lot? Are we overdoing the whole January 6th prosecution thing?
I mean, it seems like this entire conversation is still hinging on the question, was it a honest to God conspiracy, maybe headed by Stuart Rhodes, that just was kind of incompetent? Or was it a surprisingly effective, spontaneous thing that just welled up, perhaps in response to Donald Trump's words? And like, we're not going to resolve that question. Like, it was maybe a little bit of both of those things. And if it was the former, if it really was like, nope, like this was a real deal conspiracy to try and prevent the peaceful transfer of power, then, you know, I understand why you might look at a sentence that long. I still think we have a long and horrific history of using the concept of sedition, of using the concept of terrorism to pad people's sentences when they are, in fact, doing nothing of the sort. They're doing constitutionally protected activities that we just really, really, really don't like. But if it's the latter, then it really makes no sense. It's just a bunch of idiots who got out of hand, in which case the sentences that were given to the hundreds, maybe as many as 1,000 other people who were charged in connection with January 6th for trespassing and that kind of thing are more appropriate and typically had commensurate sentences attached to them. Listen, the sentence seems too long to me for what happened, but almost every sentence seems too long to me, so I might not be a good gauge.
Peter, you're from Florida. The governor guy down there, the running for president guy, was asked last week whether he would pardon the January 6th defendants or Donald Trump. He said, we will be aggressive in issuing pardons. And then he did the whole day one thing, and I'll quote it out. On day one, I will have folks that will get together and look at all these cases where there are victims of weaponization or political targeting. Then he continued, and please try to follow along this sentence. If there are three other people who did the same thing, but just in a context like Black Lives Matter protests, and they don't get prosecuted at all, that is uneven application of justice. And so we're going to find ways where that did not happen, and then we will use the pardon power on a case-by-case basis. End quote. Does that strike you as an appropriate position for an aspirant to the presidency?
So I will be aggressive in answering this question. And if there are three other people on this podcast who can answer it with some sort of clarity and provide snippets of information about which quote they are actually responding to and what they mean by that, then I think we'll know. And, you know, we're going to get there, and I will be I will take advantage of every option that I have as a podcast listener and member of the panel here, because I think it's really important to answer this question toughly.
That is art.
Wow.
Slow golf clap there.
You know what? I just got my fiber fill from that word salad. Bravo. Thank you. I can have meat
that
for my next meal.
That metaphor is actually why we need generational warfare. Yeah. We can't talk about fiber on this podcast.
Speaking of fiber and podcast and Nick Gillespie's dietary restrictions, Nick.
They're choices, Matt. Every limit is an opportunity. Come on.
The 45th president of the United States sent out a special holiday message in all caps this weekend, and I'd like to read it to you and get a response, if you will. Happy Memorial Day to all, but especially to those who gave the ultimate sacrifice for the country they love, and to those in line of a very different but equally dangerous fire, stopping the threats of the terrorists, misfits, and lunatic thugs who are working feverishly from within to overturn and destroy our once great country, which has never been in greater peril than it is right now. I'm laughing because I'm thinking about stabbing. We must stop the communists, Marxists, and fascists, pigs at every turn, and make America great again. fun fact.
Ditto, Matt Welch.
But
ditto.
It is actually, it is not funny.
It's very funny. Trump, by the way, is polling at 53% in the GOP primary, which is 30 percentage points higher.
Is that among Republicans, right?
Among Republicans, 30 points higher than Ron Death Santis. Nick, this long national nightmare is never going to end.
No, can't, Matt. We took too much Ambien in the 90s. We're never waking up from this one. I think that
it's the word misfits that really gets me.
Yeah, the threat, yeah, the terrorists, misfits, and lunatic thugs.
You know, because suddenly I'm like, you know, if Glenn Danzig and Jerry Only are in, like, you know, on one side, I'm on their side of the barricade. I don't know what it's going to be. And they may not be on the same one, Matt, but
yeah,
I walk with them. I think that this sentence is far too long. Particularly, I think Jacob Sullivan's piece of Reason does a fantastic job of laying out the incoherence of the sentence based on what the jury actually found. Having said that, I want to point out that Stuart Rhodes is a Yale Law School graduate and is an idiot and is a psychopath. Like, he's not a patriot. He's not a good guy. He's not any of those things. And he said many, many intemperate things none of which should be, you know, actionable in this case, because it seems pretty clear from what the jury decided. He was not, you know, he's not Charlie Manson, even, you know, directing people from afar to be violent or anything like that. I think January 6th overall and in the prosecutorial imagination has been overblown. It's a bad thing, and the people involved who did damage should be punished. But that's not what we're talking about here. Having said that, I have on order a copy of the 1966 book co-authored by George Gilder called The Party That Lost Its Head, which is a condemnation of the Goldwater faction of the Republican Party for being, you know, insaniacs and people who have given over to raw emotionalism and stupidity. And I'm just curious what George Gilder, who walked it back and has since been, you know, a Republican pundit along with an interesting kind of believer in, you know, the digital future without peer. I think we're, you know, the reason I want to read it is because it seems to me we are in a continuing moment where the Republican Party has gone insane. And, you know, this, all of this kind of stuff and this support for somebody like Rhodes strikes me as that. If you walked away from the 2020 election thinking that Donald Trump really won the election, and as a result, like, we need an armed revolt in order to put somebody who got less than 47% of the popular vote in two, you know, consecutive elections, you really need to have your head examined. I'm sorry. It's like, come back to reality and start dealing with stuff like, how do you cut Social Security and Medicare and out of control government force in all aspects of our life and bad foreign policy? You know, can we have that conversation rather than, you know, whatever, you know, Sebastian Gorka is thinking after a Mexican meal? And he only eats legal Mexican food. None of that illegal Mexican food. But come on, you know, it's like we're having insane conversations.
I just want to
I think the best detail from the case is that there that the Oath Keepers had what has been referred to as a quick reaction force, which is a bunch of dudes and a bunch of guns at the Comfort Inn in Arlington, right? Like, which is like the dumpiest, crappiest little like roadside, like we couldn't afford the nice place hotel, and they didn't really do anything, and is like really sort of silly and kind of dumb. On the other hand, it also really was a bunch of guys with a lot of guns who seemed maybe prepared to actually use them on January 6th. And it is that sort of that dichotomy there, right? That like it is both really ridiculous and also really kind of very serious. And it's pretty hard to, I think, sort of separate this out and choose one, because it is simultaneously both absurd and the, like, there was in fact violence and there were people who showed up with guns and seemed prepared to use
them. Can't believe that you're hotel shaming the January 6th, the plotters.
Yeah. The Comfort Inn is a beautiful chain, and sometimes they even have extra, you know, like kind of vaguely before the expiration date Danish at their continental breakfast.
It seems to me like that is the right hotel for your gun and dude staging area, frankly. Like, that seems right.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email question of the week here in a moment.
Are we, Matt? Are we?
But first, America's libertarianish funny friend, Andrew Heaton, is known to you all through such recent TV classics as Libertarian Star Trek and Libertarian Star Wars. Appropriately enough, the droll fellow hosts his very own science fiction podcast, which is called Alienating the Audience. Alienating the Audience is all about science fiction. Robert A. Heinlein's Free Love Libertarianism, The Economics of Dune, Kurt Vonnegut and the Warfare State, How Star Wars Andor Embraces Public Choice Theory, and so forth. Guests on the show have included Peter Boghossian on what the first contact with aliens will be like, Jonathan Last from The Bulwark defending the Empire, Tim Sandifer of the Goldwater Institute on Star Trek and the Cold War, and Catherine Mang-Yu Ward herself discussing the work of Dan Simmons. If you do not like science fiction, do not listen to Alienating the Audience, because there's an excellent chance your virginity will grow back. But if you do like science fiction, with some politics and economics thrown in, served fresh by a C-list comedian, then check out Alienating the Audience wherever you get your podcasts. Please do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email us your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Will Collins, who must have a great time at Will Call. Get it? I'd like to ask you all, but particularly Dr. Gillespie, to square two points. He's got to wake up from his session over there. To square 2 points he raised in the course of last week's discussion. The first is the reason-wide attitude of broad support for immigration, immigrants, and their positive impact on the economy. The second is the downplaying of the importance of birth rates on economic growth and, to a lesser extent, social cohesion. Immigrants will only buy us a very small window of time. Last week, he continues, I read a thoughtful piece in Palladium by Adam Van Buskirk titled Industrial Civilization Needs a Biological Future, which you should check out. It laid out a compelling argument that if the technocratic class who do the critical engineering and design work of supporting modernity stops reproducing, the world will eventually run out of modernity. Poaching smart professionals from peer societies might work as a strategy for the U.S. for about another decade, give or take, but eventually we'll need to square the demand for global economic growth with the fact that the parts of the world with favorable demography do not produce a large number of technocrats and, frankly, do not look poised to increase that output to a significant degree in our lifetimes. I personally hope for 50 billion human souls to eventually colonize the solar system, and I submit that sticking to the pro-immigrant parenthood-neutral stance is short-sighted and a bit selfish if libertarians want to do better at articulating a positive vision of the future. Nick, you've been named. What say you?
I appreciate the question. I want to point out that I just was in California to celebrate the college graduation of my second son. So I am nearly at replacement level. And actually, if you consider the contributions I've made, my two children have already contributed far more than I ever did. So I'm happy for that. While I was out in California, I actually had a meal with Dr. Marian Tupi, the co-author of the fantastic book Superabundance, with Dr. Gail Pooley. And they rest their argument that continued economic growth and or superabundance actually is predicated upon increasing global fertility rates. So there is a broad consensus, you know, and there is a historical reality that no society has actually enjoyed long-term economic growth with declining population. Having said all of that, there is, absolutely fertility rates are declining globally and they will continue to. There is nothing that will reverse that, I would argue, because it's a response to modernity itself, particularly the increased status and equal status of women across the world. This is not controversial among demographers. So we have to figure out a world in which we continue to have economic growth with fewer people over the long run. I'm extremely optimistic that that will take place. My embrace of immigration, in the meantime, is less driven by the need for a growing economy and more of, I would say it's more of a moral argument. I mean, I think empirically increased immigration is good for the country. It's good for everything. But my main argument for it is that it's right for the people who want to move to be able to live where they want to live and build a life where they want to live.
Catherine, you're a lady. Sounds like it's your fault, first of all. And second of all, how do you...
Nope, always.
How do you...
There's only one person on this particular podcast who is not holding up their end of the population bomb.
Absolutely true, as far as we know.
Actually, all of us aren't.
Yeah, that's true. We got to go, go 2.0.
None of us have replacement rated ourselves.
Pretty close.
As we discussed, and I know Matt's trying to answer questions. Go ahead,
no,
Matt.
No, just go ahead. Sorry. I'm restating the question. So re-answer the restated question.
Yeah. First of all, I want to say we have already established that it is, in fact, the breeders on this podcast's fault that we're not making more humans because the non-child having rate is not the issue. It's the how many kids do the kid havers have rate that's the issue. Anyway, Elizabeth Nolan Brown has an excellent cover story, which we talked about before. I would say I like this question a lot, too. I would say that the pro-immigration stance and the parenthood neutral stance come from the same place, which is the desire to respect individual choice stance. And right now we are really, as a country, standing in the way of lots of people who would choose to come here and contribute. We are not mostly standing in the way of people who want to have kids, but for some reason can't because of the state. So that matches up for me. That said, I am absolutely like a transhumanist futurist about this question of the 50 billion souls to colonize the solar system. Like, it's true that women in modern societies don't like to have a ton of babies, but that is potentially a logistical problem. That's like a technological problem. So I think once there is a place to put 50 billion souls out in the galaxy, we're going to figure out how to make those souls. We're going to grow them in vats. We're going to clone them. We're going to upload our brains and duplicate them. I don't know. But I just feel like this is a problem that can be solved a whole bunch of ways besides making the uterus havers use their uteruses more. So it's going to be fine.
I just, so much imagery in that question that I wish I could unimagine.
I feel like I was surprisingly, I was accidentally woke there. I was like, hashtag accidentally woke to use uterus havers, but I stand by it.
Peter, you're a uterus non-haver and kid non-haver too. Do you see a contradiction in these two strains of libertarian thought?
I just want to say that I think people are going to be really mad about the artificial wombs. And there's going to be a decade of attempts to outlaw that.
The womb
no,
wars.
It's not just going to be the womb wars. We're going to end up with the Womb Act, the Women Only Make Babies Act, right? Which is going to prohibit, the artificial.
It's conjured it into being.
it's there. No. It's waiting for us in our future.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm worried about, is the bad legislative acronyms that are going to come from baby making technology that offloads the job from women to the robots.
Right. I mean, it is clearly true that all of the people who are losing their minds about the fertility question and nativists in particular are going to then, when presented with a great solution to make more American babies, be very against it, like soups dupes against
but they'll come
it. And
up,
they are going to do the Suderman legislation.
They'll come up
sure.
with ways to, you know, actively categorize, like they'll have more immigrants who are like not white or not American or not, you know, capable of democracy. And they'll have those kids grind out people, and then they'll be like, oh yeah, no, those are real Americans. I, you know, when Steve King of Iowa, who's really kind of the nexus of this horror show, I, you know, a couple of years ago when he talked about you can't build civilization, you can't rebuild civilization with other people's babies, it was the first time I realized that my parents were other people's babies. And, you know, my father fought in World War II. My mother worked and raised kids. And, like, you know, they were the children of immigrants from shithole countries. So like, and, you know, by the time they were adults, they were fully American, you know, they were as American as, you know, fucking Joe DiMaggio, Matt or Babe Ruth or something like that. So we'll figure out a way to rechristen everybody we need in order to have enough kids. Why? I think the question is a really interesting one because it does point to the issue that we are going to have to, the future is going to be different than the past. And if the future relies on, you know, the engineering class having lots of kids, you know, we don't have a future. We're going to have to do something different. And I'm very happy, you know, that we'll be able to do that. And in a way that won't replicate the plot line of Arnold Schwarzenegger's Junior, where he carries a baby.
So I actually just want to disagree with something that Nick said at the very beginning, which is that Nick, you know, suggested that we are going to have to figure out a way to deal with declining population growth. And I'm not sure that in the long term, that's definitely going to be true. I can just imagine a world in which population growth really kicks back up. And the thing is that I don't think that that world is going to come about because of decisions made in legislatures, in state houses, because of public policy decisions made to spend money on promoting childbirth and on natalism. I think that is going to come, if it does, because of changes in the culture. And it is, and people who are really concerned about this and who want a world with a lot more kids and where it's easier to have kids, where people are more inclined to have more kids, where instead of two kids, you have four or six on average, right? Where the people who are having the kids but not enough are actually doing their part, then you're going to have to change the culture to do it, because it is a cultural problem. It is, I think, the thing that Liz Nolan Brown establishes most in her really excellent feature story is that there's just no way to solve this via public policy, because at best you can make very, very small improvements in birth rates by spending a huge, huge amount of money. And to connect this back to our earlier discussion, the money to do that just is not there, not even in the biggest, most advanced, most wealthy economies in the world. And so we don't have the money to boost rates enough to make a big difference, which means that if folks want people to have more babies, what we're going to have to do is change the culture. And I don't think that cultural change is impossible or definitely not going to happen. But I do think that that's where it's going to come from. And cultural changes are difficult to predict in advance. The world is very different now than it was 50 years ago. And 50 years ago, the world was, you know, very different than 50 years before that. We don't know what the culture is going to be like in 50 years and how the next generations are going to approach these questions.
The one thing that we do know, I think, and I'll just to push back, Peter, the long-term, century-long fertility rates, they're all going down. And, you know, even the American baby boom after World War II was not observed all over the world, et cetera. It's like, I think it's a pretty safe bet to say, in the same way that the future is going to have fewer cases of diphtheria and less slavery and things like that, it's going to have fewer kids.
I just, this whole thing is reminding me of that bad late 90s Alterna rock song by the band whose name I forget, where he looks around the world and notices only stupid people are breeding. And I don't even own a TV, he says afterwards, incongruously. And back then we used to laugh at it. Now it is the subject of conservative magazines. So I don't know what to think about all that. And that and the movie Idiocracy too. People laughed at it at the time. Now it seems to be all the rage. I think it's always important to think in terms of places, polities, whether cities or states or countries, in terms of population growth, as indications of their robustness. Doesn't answer the question, but I certainly think about that all the time. California, where Nick just was, has been growing at a flat rate compared to the rest of the country, just at the same rate, which is absolutely different than it was the California of my childhood, which grew 2.5 to 4.5 times faster than the rest of the country. And that changes the dynamic of everything. The cover story under my editorship that surprisingly just never got me called as a racist, it was the one where Barack Obama was turning Japanese, and we were using that as a look at what would happen with fiscal policies, which we were talking about earlier on this podcast. What would happen if you just start spending all this money and you don't care about debt? You have this sort of long period like Japan has had. Japan has also lost population over time. It's come in an older and more sclerotic society. I've never been to Japan, have no concept of the place. Kind of feel like we all should visit now, since it's more going to be more of our future than even we thought back in 2009. All right, let's go to a lightning round. Last week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis officially announced his candidacy for president on a very glitch-filled session or attempted sessions on Twitter Spaces, which I'd never been on before that. So that was really exciting, with Elon Musk and David Sachs and a cast of characters, including Thomas Massie, Christopher Rufo, and Dana Lash, among others. He did a very awkward stump speech, followed by some less awkward but still very soft-tossed questioning. It was just weird. Let's go around the table and hear one takeaway each about the DeLaunch. Peter, you're from Florida. You go first.
Once they finally got the technology working, the opening stump speech might as well have been written by ChatGPT if you asked it to write a stump speech for a generic Republican. It was simply the most personality-free vanilla speech I have heard from a major politician in years. And it wasn't even so much that it gave me no specific reason to dislike DeSantis all that much, except in the way that I both, you know, sort of tolerate and frequently dislike Republican politicians. It was just that there was nothing there except like a list of bullet points that you could have just generated without having an actual person behind it. And this is, I think, going to be a through line in the DeSantis campaign, is that he seems intent on running without a personality.
Catherine, takeaway.
When you say it like that, it sounds restful. like a personalityless candidate. Sounds good. Yeah. So my takeaway, I at this point am just fully like a stan for the Eric Boehm like take on DeSantis, which is after the announcement, which was that he's the two online candidate. Peter is right about the opening remarks, but then the question and answer, you know, the kind of chatter period afterward, he said a lot of stuff that only people who have been paying way too much attention to like Twitter and the nitty gritty of kind of culture war stuff, especially online culture war stuff, would even begin to comprehend. This has always been a criticism of Trump as well, but Trump sort of speaks on two levels, the way too online level and the real America level. DeSantis seems like only way too online. I was actually chatting with a new listener to our podcast recently, and he was like, yeah, I really liked a recent episode, but what's a NatCon? And I was like, oh, yeah. Like, we are also way too online. And so the stuff that DeSantis was saying in that announcement kind of sounded interesting and engaged with the concerns that I have. But it's hard for me to imagine what America is going to hear. And maybe America is never going to hear that stuff. They're just going to hear the ChatGPT Republican guy give speeches and talk at the debates.
Dr. Gillespie.
It's interesting if he used Twitter to talk to a mostly online crowd and he's too online. So maybe it's actually kind of smart that way. My takeaway from it was less about the substance and more the media fixation and Democrats and critics of DeSantis, including Trump, pouncing on the glitchiness of the launch just confirmed to me you know, that the media in general will always go for the dumbest, least interesting aspect of every possible event. And yeah, that's
it. Was funny though.
It's always funny, Matt. It's always funny.
Everything is funny, he says, crying. Just a small observation, bubbled in my head while listening to you guys talk, is that we never really had, especially during Trump's first run at the presidency, there wasn't you could count on one hand the number of journalists who liked Trump. I'm like, yeah, this is my guy, and who were articulating for him. There's been this kind of backfilled ideology created to inhabit that space or take advantage of it since then. So people have developed that, but there's that initial kind of journalistic fanboy character didn't really exist. It does for DeSantis. So it's a little bit startling to watch people kind of get all gushy. And they got all gushy on the thing to Elon Musk, too, just portraying him as this this fantastic free speech champion, which I think is a stretch at this point in his career. Just that, you know, he's got a spotty record like most people do who are in that business. There is a contingent among people who are commentators and journalists involved in conservative stuff who get kind of blushy and stammery around Ron DeSantis. And it's socially awkward to observe and kind of interesting on that level. All right, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming. I understand that there's been a rear guard action to combine forces here to talk about television shows that ended over the weekend. Peter, why don't you lead off the Suderman Gillespie discussion of what has ended?
Both Succession and Barry, both of which air on HBO on Sunday nights, and aired the final episodes of their four-season runs on Sunday night. And I think both turned in really stellar performances. Both are two of my favorite shows of the last 5 or 6 years. Succession, in particular, really nailed its critique of the American elite as essentially pathetic, weak-willed, indecisive, totally unwilling to do anything that might have real consequences that they would have to take responsibility for, but surprisingly adept at exactly one thing, which is preserving their own privilege and power. It's a great, sharp, funny, incredibly vulgar show that just is filled with delight in profanity and in interesting language, which is one of the things that makes it great. It's really nicely observed, and its visual details includes some really great acting, including by, of all people, Kieran Culkin. Yes, Kieran Culkin, I believe he's the brother of Macaulay Culkin. I'm not, unless I'm totally just hallucinating that, ChatGPT style. Who in the show's most dramatic moments often sort of has to take the lead and and just do some genuinely great acting. The fourth season was more dramatic and maybe a little less funny, but still quite pointed and sharp and just comically rich. And the final episode is one of the most successful final episodes of a show that has up until that point been good, I think, of the last 20 years or so. First of all, because it's just a good episode of television. And without spoiling too much, it takes the core trio of children who have always been the main heirs to the throne of the big media empire. That's sort of the stakes that's in play in the show. And it transforms them back into children by sending them basically to go hang out on the beach with their mom. And it reminds you that these are just little kids playing in their father's sandbox in a way that is incredibly artful and not at all sort of overly like an annoying metaphor. And then the ending in which it actually in which there's a big twist, things actually break down, is just, it's just kind of perfect, and it includes one of the greatest, not quite final images, but like near final images I think I have ever seen in a television show. I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it, but suffice to say, I just really recommend this series as a look at America's power elite, and literally just the problems that America is having with leadership succession right now, with the transfer of generational power, in which the people who have led and built institutions over since World War II are kind of awful. They're kind of horrible people, and yet they have a will and a vigor and a vitality and an ability to build, and it's not at all clear what comes next or if anybody else has that ability to make something real in the world and change the world according to their own will. Anyway, great show. Really enjoyed the finale.
Nick, take the baton, please.
I don't know what our policy on spoiler alerts are, but so I will
them, pause and then go ahead.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you are still chewing over Succession or whether or not you're going to watch it. Disappear for a couple of minutes. I'm not going to go into anything super specific. I agree with Peter's broad take, and he has a very good piece up at Reason.com. Everybody should read. This is a story about generational change. And the way I read it, though, there's no question, you know, the older generation, and this is the post-World War II generation, the Rupert Murdoch generation, the patriarch of the show, is obviously in some profound way a stand-in for Murdoch. But it's more than that. He has kids who are fucking entitled, lazy, kind of stupid, and they did not learn the business that they insist is theirs to take over. They insist the world is theirs to take over, and they are not ready for it. And they get their comeuppance on that in a way, which I think is very interesting and very pleasing. Where I would disagree with Peter on a certain level is the world does continue, and there is a new kind of stream of energy coming in a character who is an empire builder from Sweden, of all places. It's a really good I'll say this. The show, I hate watched it because it is written in the most ridiculous way possible. People are constantly using phrases that don't exist in business or previously in the English language, but everybody acts as if these phrases were there. Very enjoyable show, very enjoyable finale, and it is echoing the larger generational shifts that are going on between millennials and Gen Z, who are being cock-blocked by boomers and, you know, Gen X people who just aren't getting out of the way for a wide variety of reasons. And so in that sense, it's very enjoyable and very on point.
Really appreciate your comment about the phrasing there. It's just like the way of the zebra. Get it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Catherine.
I'm just pretend. But may I, Matt? Because yeah. I was going to talk about Barry, the okay. other show that ended, which is a creation of Bill Hader, a four series arc about a soldier who becomes a killer who becomes an actor. It is an incredibly great series, super violent, a formidable, although I'm not sure exactly what the import ultimately is. To me, I read it as a critique of Hollywood and of the entertainment industry. And it is super violent, super funny, super engaging. And the real revelation, Matt, and I think as somebody who grew up loving Henry Winkler and the Fonz, like you've spent your whole life trying to be like Fonzie, Henry Winkler has emerged in the final third of his career between this and shows like Arrested Development and even being the patriarch in Holes. The Disney movie is so fucking great, and he gets the exact fate that he deserves, as does the generation of Hollywood that he represents. I highly recommend Barry.
Henry Winkler, very underrated turn in Night Shift. Incredible. Michael Keaton.
No, he's good in everything. Good in everything. Fonzie is the least of his roles.
Catherine, what did you consume, and was it a television show?
It was not a television show. It was a podcast. I am always seeking to understand you, Matt.
No, you're not.
And I really am, honestly. But I've started listening to, I am several episodes into a podcast that Eric Boehm actually recommended in the brief reviews a couple issues back. 60 songs that explain the 90s. They are now up to, I think, like 92 songs. So 82 songs, I can't remember. So we're beyond the stated purview. The best way that I can describe it is, I think many fans of this podcast also are listeners to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. And it's the vibe of Hardcore History, including the man with a really gravelly voice who has both incredible sort of self-seriousness and seriousness of purpose, and also a slightly like beaten dog demeanor. In this case, it is The Ringer's Rob Harvilla, but applied to just like songs from the 90s. So it's like the same tone that you're like, nuclear war. Except for this week, it was Salt and Pepper. You know what I mean? And it works. Like, it really, really works. So the first, like, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes of this week's episode is just him painting in this gravelly voice a portrait of the middle school dance. And we run through several songs that are playing on the middle school dance. We culminate in Salt and Pepper's Greatest Hits, and then just like move through that. It's a good podcast. It's clearly targeted at people who are between Suderman and Matt Walsh, right? Like that's your generational window. If you feel ever that when Suderman or Matt are talking, or me, like that is about you, you will probably enjoy this podcast. But like, you have to have been at that middle school dance sometime in the window that he is describing to really fully appreciate this podcast. But it has a bunch of good libertarian-y notes in it as well. There's, of course, he documents all of the First Amendment fights, the, you know, parental advisory stuff. It's all in there, but it's mostly just a weirdly intense nostalgia trip down 90s.
I just want to say that every time I listen to Losing My Edge by LCD Sound System, which is often, I think of Matt. And so this is, it's a song about like an old guy who like knows everything about music.
Careful.
But is like kind of aging out of it and worried that the kids are going to like be sharper because he's losing his edge. It's so great. It's one of my favorite songs. And it just like, oh, I used to work in the record store. I had everything before everyone. And that's, yeah, right? This is Matt.
It's not a coincidence that this host also has a middle school aged son. So there is, for instance, the truly excellent episode on Torn, as performed by Natalie and Brulia for us 90s kids, but in fact, a cover of a cover of a cover. He like plays it for his son and has a moment about it.
You can't say the name of that song without me getting just a little bit verklempt. Let's be honest about that. I think you all are thinking about me too much and my musical tastes, and I feel uncomfortable, and I'm going to make a note
to my
boss.
Don't shame us, Matt, just because we're low-key obsessed with you.
I consumed not a 90s song or anything related to baseball this week, but rather went to the American Museum of Natural History, of which I am a member. They have a new wing, the Richard Gilder Center for Science, Education, and Innovation. It's like a big old honeycomb hideout. It's pretty cool. It's a kind of a new building. That place is impossible to walk around and understand where you are. So now it's kind of even more impossible. I don't know. But anyways, it looks great. You could see it online. The big stairways, sit down kind of place. It looks like you're in kind of a beehive. The ground floor has a very cool insects thing where literal honeycombs coming down out of the roof. It's very good for kids on that. They have one of those required trip out rooms at every museum. I don't know when this happened, but like somewhere over the last couple of years, like they just realized that half the people who go to museums are either stoned out of their minds like Nick Gillespie, or they are children, or both. And so they have, you know, you go into a room, it's connections. Here's the connections of DNA. And
I love that room in all the museums now.
And there's the ecosystem of the ocean. And look, when you move your foot, it follows you, the plankton. So obviously my 8-year-old loved it very much. But it's a very nice space. It's good addition to the old Teddy Roosevelt Museum. Only thing I would just like to say to my fellow claustrophobes is that you're probably right to have the instinct not to go into the butterfly vivarium. Like a small enclosed hot room crowded with people and things flying around your ears.
Butterflies?
So don't do it. Just let the rest of the family do that. Am I talking out loud? I think I am. Okay. That's all the time that we have to talk out loud here on this podcast. Thank you for listening. Nick Gillespie, are there some New York events you would like to hype? Perhaps one involving Catherine Timpf?
Yeah. On Monday, June 5th in New York City in Midtown, we will be doing a live taping of the recent interview with Kat Timpf of The Gutfeld Show, Fox News more generally, and the best-selling book, You Can't Joke About That. So go to reason.com/events to get details and tickets. It's going to be a whole lot of fun in one of the coolest settings in Midtown Manhattan, June 5th.
Awesome. Go to all of our podcasts at reason.com podcasts. And you can give us money if you like. We're a nonprofit. Reason.com/donate. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.